right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Well, friends and listeners, it seems like every week right now is like a month in the before times. A lot has happened. Trump, who was impeached after the failed coup attempt, faced trial in the Senate and was acquitted. There is a major question posed to all of us. What does that mean? And the answer seems to range from it doesn't mean anything to we are totally screwed. We'll be talking about this a lot in this coming week. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear a segment from a Refuse Fascism video on the Senate impeachment trial and the need to refuse fascism with Sam Goldman of Refuse Fascism and Jared Yates Sexton, a professor and political analyst. This was recorded before the verdict in the Senate trial. Before that, we'll hear a segment from the RNL, or Revolution Nothing Less show, on Bob Avakian for the liberation of black people and the emancipation of all humanity. But before we get into any of that, I want to read an editorial from the website revcom.us, and that's entitled The Impeachment Verdict from the Senate and the Shamelessness of the Republifascists. This past week witnessed the second Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump. The House of Representatives, led by the Democratic majority, had voted to impeach Trump on January 13th. This was then sent to the Senate for trial with assigned House Democrats as impeachment managers, making the case to the senators as jurors. The trial focused on Trump's action to overturn the election, with an emphasis on the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, an attempted fascist coup. Five people died in this attack and scores were injured as the crowd outside celebrated around a gallows and a huge cross, waving flags of the slavery-defending Confederacy and Trump himself. Through the use of powerful videotapes and timelines, an undeniable case was made by the impeachment managers that Trump himself made clear statements that the only outcome of the 2020 election that he would accept was if he won. Trump lied repeatedly that an overwhelming victory had been stolen by fraud in order to convince his followers that they must fight to overturn this election and prevent Biden from taking office. Trump had a history dating back years of inciting fascist physical attacks on members of the press and dissenters who entered his rallies. His continued encouragement of illegal police violence and even murder against presumably innocent people, as well as calling members of the violent fascist mob that killed Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, North Carolina in 2017, quote, very fine people. Trump called for, organized, and planned the mass action at the Capitol to stop the steal, that is, to illegally prevent the legal certifying of the election for Biden, despite Biden's clear victory, one which had been affirmed by numerous state Republican officials. While Trump's followers, armed with tasers, bear spray, weaponized flagpoles, displaying Trump, U.S., and Confederate flags, and assorted other weapons, were storming the Capitol building hunting for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Pence, with intent to kill or maim them and others. And even after he had been notified by at least one senator and the leader of the House Republicans that dangerous, life-threatening physical attacks were going on, he continued more than once to give his blessing and encouragement to those who were clearly carrying out what he wanted. In the face of this and other clear evidence and what everyone, even many Republicans, said was an incompetent legal defense of Trump, the vote to convict Trump was 57-50. In the face of this and other clear evidence and what everyone, even many Republicans, said was an incompetent legal defense of Trump, the vote to convict Trump was 57, 50 Democrats and 7 Republicans, while 43 Republicans voted to acquit, falling short of the 67 votes needed to convict in an impeachment. In other words, Republican senators in their majority voted that Trump was not to be found guilty of any of this. They made clear that their allegiance is to Trump and to the whole fascist movement that they have now solidified. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell attempted to have it both ways, excoriating Trump's behavior on the 6th while staying silent on everything that had gone on before and paved the way for the 6th, which he, McConnell, had aided and abetted in numerous ways, and then proceeding to vote against conviction on grounds that were at best flimsy and in actual fact invalid. In so doing, they all validated Trump as the continued leader of the Republifascist and validated as well the practice of armed fascist vigilantes, organized and unorganized, seizing the public square and threatening all who dare to cross them. This drives home what Bob Avakian has written in his New Year statement, A New Year, the Urgent Need for a Radically New World for the Emancipation of All Humanity. The reality has to be confronted that, as expressed through the election, nearly half this country has passionately, aggressively, and belligerently embraced what is represented by Trumpism. The unavoidable truth is that this country, the much-proclaimed shining city on a hill, is full of fascists, in the government, at all levels, and in large parts of the society as a whole. And a defining characteristic of these fascists is their fanatical allegiance to demented distortions of reality, which is extremely difficult, and in many cases, impossible, to penetrate with reason and fact, because these distortions serve to reinforce their sense of threatened entitlement and render long-standing prejudices and hatreds even more virulent. This fascism is deeply rooted in the underlying dynamics of the capitalist imperialist system that rules in this country and in the whole history of this country, from its founding in slavery and genocide. Related to this is another critical truth. Biden will fail miserably in this attempt to bring about healing and unite the country. As I have written previously, Biden and the Democrats cannot bring the country together, as they falsely claim, because there can be no reconciliation with these fascists, whose grievances are based on fanatical resentment against any limitation on white supremacy, male supremacy, xenophobia, which is hatred of foreigners, rabid American chauvinism, and the unrestrained plundering of the environment, and are increasingly expressed in literally lunatic terms. There can be no reconciliation with this, other than on the terms of these fascists, with all the terrible implications and consequences of that. That was the impeachment verdict from the Senate and the shamelessness of the Republic of Fascists. And right now we'll hear a segment from the RNL, or Revolution Nothing Less show, on Bob Avakian for the liberation of black people and the emancipation of all humanity.
Last September 17th, RevCom.us published an article titled Bob Avakian for the Liberation of Black People and the Emancipation of All Humanity. This is an extremely important article that you can find today at the top of our website, RevCom.us. I want to start this segment by reading from Basics, the handbook for an actual revolution, Basics from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian, Basics 319. Bob Avakian says, There will never be a revolutionary movement in this country that doesn't fully unleash and give expression to the sometimes openly expressed, sometimes expressed in partial ways, sometimes expressed in wrong ways, but deeply, deeply felt desire to be rid of these long centuries of oppression of black people. There's never going to be a revolution in this country, and there never should be, that doesn't make that one of the key foundations of what it's all about. Just repeat that. There's never going to be a revolution in this country, and there never should be, that doesn't make that one key foundation of what it's all about, speaking of the liberation of black people. For Bob Avakian, B.A., the liberation of black people is not only a critical matter of strategy and theory, it is at the core of who he is. This article brings this to life, taking you through how Bob Avakian developed this deep feeling, and it chronicles how this fueled his path-breaking work on the struggle and liberation of black people, a continuing body of work that he's done over decades. And this article, Bob Avakian for the Liberation of Black People and the Emancipation of All Humanity, is a crucial supplement to that New Year's statement by Bob Avakian. Why is this? Plainly put, because of what I've just read from Basics. And for black people to get free from the legacy and the continuing brutality and inequality of this system that has white supremacy woven into its very fabric, for black people to play their crucial role in a revolution aimed at freeing all of humanity, they need to follow Bob Avakian. As we dig into this article today and subsequent episodes, we'll be making the case why black people need to become active, ardent followers of BA, doing so with the full recognition of the importance of taking up the whole of the new communism. Look, given the legacy of white supremacy and the current pervasiveness of identity politics and of cancel culture, this will involve people going up against the prevailing culture, going against the grain. It will take intellectual and moral courage and a scientific approach to understanding the problem and the solution. But once again, the hour is late. And for the last few decades, Black people have faced the slow genocide of the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration, police murder, and like Latinos, disproportionate death from the COVID-19 virus. But there is a way out, and that is getting with BA and supporting and joining with the movement for an actual revolution for the emancipation of all humanity, overthrowing this dog-eat-dog world of capitalism, imperialism, uprooting all the modes of thinking and striving to get a bone from the capitalists or to become a big dog within this system. There really is a world to win, and there are people all over the planet who would rejoice if they saw a revolution taking place here. Millions of people around the world took heart from the beautiful rising this spring against the wanton racist police murder of George Floyd. And millions of people all around the world who a half century later still take inspiration and heart from the struggles of Black people in the 1960s and wonder about those struggles. Because those struggles ran up against not only the repressive power of the imperialists and their state, but also up against the limits of the understanding of how a revolution could actually be won and what it really needs to be for. Once again, drawing from the song by Bob Dylan, All Along the Watchtower, we must not speak falsely here. While there was heroic and inspiring struggle in the 1960s, while millions righteously stood up and protested last spring, there were no answers put forth but minor reforms of a system that has white supremacy woven into it, as I said. There are those who have produced important work describing the history and the present reality of the oppression of Black people. But they have no fundamental answers to the roots of this oppression and to how to end it. The work that Bob Avakian has done on this is unparalleled and it's liberating and it could lead to finally ending it. BA, with tremendous heart and soul, with a tremendous interrogation of the complexity of revolution here and for the emancipation of humanity, has developed the road forward, and he's leading that struggle today. And that's a really big deal. So now I want to let the article and others speak and bring to you the first segment in what will be several segments on Bob Avakian for the liberation of Black people and the emancipation of all humanity. The article begins like this.
One of the things that comes through most powerfully in Bob Avakian's memoir is that a profound hatred for the oppression of Black people has been a defining part of Bob Avakian's life. From the time as a teenager, he learned about the lives of the Black people with whom he developed deep ties of friendship. Never feeling that because he is white, it is not his place to be involved in the struggle against this oppression, but on the contrary, determined to contribute whatever he could to this struggle, Bob Avakian, BA, from the time he worked closely with the Black Panther Party in its revolutionary days in the 1960s, has made the liberation of Black people a defining part of his life's commitment and work. As he developed as a revolutionary communist and emerged as the foremost revolutionary leader and thinker in the world, this commitment has become even deeper and has been strongly interwoven with a dedication to the emancipation of all humanity from every form of oppression and exploitation. Listen to Nocha Diaz read what B.A. has written about his life's work.
Why was I doing the work I was doing? Once again, we're back to for whom and for what. I wasn't doing this work for myself. When I was young, in middle school, and then even more so in high school, my life got changed in a very major way by coming into contact with people that I hadn't really known that much before, in particular Black people. I started learning about their situation and how that relates to what goes on in this society as a whole. I was drawn to the culture, not just the music and art overall, but the whole way of going through the world of the Black people who became my friends and the world they introduced me to. And I came to the point of recognizing, these are my people. Now, I knew they had a different life experience than I did, but these are my people. I don't see a separation. It's not like there are some other people over there who are going through all this, and somehow that's removed from me. These are my people. And then I began to recognize more deeply what people were being put through, the oppression they were constantly subjected to, the horrors of daily life, as well as the bigger ways in which the system came down on them. And as I went further through life and began to approach the question of what needs to be done about this, and was introduced to taking up a scientific approach to this, I realized that my people were more than this. I realized that my people were Chicanos and other Latinos and other oppressed people in the U.S. They were people in Vietnam and China. They were women. They were the oppressed and exploited of the world. And through some struggle and having to cast off some wrong thinking, I've learned that they are LGBT people as well. These are my people, the oppressed and exploited people of the world. They are suffering terribly, and something has to be done about this. So it is necessary to dig in and systematically take up the science that can show the way to put an end to all this and bring something much better into being. You have to persevere and keep struggling to go forward in this way. And when you run into new problems or setbacks, you have to go more deeply into this rather than putting it aside and giving up. But this is why I've been doing the work I've been doing.
So that was Bob Avakian for the liberation of Black people and the emancipation of all of humanity. That's the beginning of that article. And you heard Noche Diaz reading Bob Avakian speaking about why it is that he's doing the work he's doing. And that comes from the book, The New Communism. After this, the article goes into Bob Avakian's development around the oppression of Black people, the struggle of Black people, how he has developed his thinking and writing articles and being active within this, all the way up to his work today. But, you know, I made the point at the beginning of this, why for Black people to get free, they have to become emancipators of humanity and become followers of Bob Avakian. And so what we want to do is bring you a longtime follower of Bob Avakian, Joe Veal. Joe Veal grew up in Berkeley, California. He joined the Black Panther Party when he was young, and he got into the life, he served time in prison, and he joined the revolution in the 1970s. And just in the last few weeks, he was on a Zoom call with other revolutionaries talking about how they got into Bob Avakian and how they became followers of Bob Avakian. I want to show more of it today because it's very deep, and I think it's very relevant to people watching this saying, thinking to themselves, well, you know, could I become a follower of Bob Avakian? And why does it matter? Why does it make a difference? So let's just go to Joe Veal right now. This is a really important segment.
I start like this, I knew B.A. even before I met him, We grew up in the same city in Berkeley and stuff. And the Panthers, started in Oakland, which was right next to Berkeley. I knew a lot of the Panthers from the ones that, started and stuff. And they were, they was telling, what they were doing. They had developed this organization. They were trying to make revolution, to overthrow the system, into the oppression of Black people. I mean, it was straight up about like that. And that, racism, went with that, eliminating that. That was not working within the system, but working to overthrow it. And they made it clear to me that they was trying to build this not only amongst Black people, they was trying to build this amongst whites. The support for this amongst whites, as well as other different races and nationalities and stuff. And in that context, BA's name always came up. It was Bob Avakian. I hadn't met him. I wasn't a Panther yet, but I knew about him because that's what they were saying. This was the main people who supported them and stuff. And then when I started going to their rallies and stuff, that's what I would like see on the stage with these other, Black revolutionaries, Black militants. BA would be right up there, like speaking, like with them about Black liberation and stuff, supporting like the Panthers and stuff like that. So I, you know, from right from the beginning, when I joined the Panthers, you know, I was, you know, and I joined in Richmond, California. That's the branch I went in. RUBA, they was in Richmond. I didn't notice at the time, but they were in Richmond doing their work because they was, you know, taking revolutionary politics. He talks about in the memoir, you know, his memoir about taking revolutionary politics, like the poor whites and stuff. Richmond is, you know, proletarian like city of different like nationalities and stuff like that. So out there in Richmond, you know, I got, you know, I would see him come by the office. He's talking to the, you know, the leadership there in Richmond, the captain. And sometimes I'll be at the national office, which was in Berkeley. I see him like come through like there and stuff, talking to some of the national like leaders and stuff like this here and everything, you know. And then, you know, I remember like, you know, one occasion, it was this community college. He talks about this, that they're doing work there. And the Panthers did work there too, a Contra Costa Community College and stuff. And I remember, and this is when I first had a real like close encounter, like with BA and stuff, like, you know, like more like face to face. And it was the thing, and one of the things that really like struck me, because at that point I had never met anyone that was so passionately about Free Huey. And Huey Newton was in, Huey Newton, one of the founders of the Panthers. He was facing a murder charge for the shootout with the Oakland police and stuff. They're trying to put him in a gas chamber. B.A., I said, him, he got Free Huey buttons all over. I never knew. And so it was really striking, like, to me. And then he also had Mao Zedong buttons all over. You know, and the Panthers was into popularizing the Red Book. But he was just as passionate about Mao and revolution and stuff. And I hadn't met anybody white, just be frank, like that, who was so like passionate about Black liberation and communist revolution. You know, it was real like, you know, striking and stuff like to me and everything. So I always knew on a certain level, I always knew. And then I found out, you know, that me and B.A., you know, we had some of the same friends. I know he talks about one of his friends, like Billy, he talks about. He was a friend of mine. Billy was, it was a little old, so I looked up to him. Billy, you know, he ended up being in the light. I was kind of like in that too, and I was kind of idolizing Billy like that and shit. But this was a friend of B.A. that he knew really well. He was struggling with Billy, trying to, you know, getting to do something else with his life. He understood. You know, he wasn't like blaming Billy for being in the situation that he was in. He was blaming the system and shit, and trying to get Billy like to see that and stuff like that. But he really understood, and he had a real, you tell, he had a real lot of affection and stuff like that from, you know, for him and stuff. Before, so when I realized that, and then I learned that this BA had genuine friends like this, this had a big impression like on me. And stuff. I just have to be straight up like about it. So when I went to prison, I started reading some of the literature. People started struggling with me in prison. People were struggling with me about, hey, if you really like serious, you got to read this. And the first thing they had me to read was Red Paper. I knew B.A. had wrote, but I had to read Red Paper 5 and 6. Because both of those was about the Black national question. I had to read it. And I had already read, I had studied, listened to Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm X, all his recordings over and over. I had read Franz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, you know. I had read all the stuff from, like, the Panthers and the Panthers leaders and stuff about this contradict, this question, this Black national question, and what's the solution. But when I read Red Papers, I had to, you know, I had to acknowledge I'd never seen this kind of approach, the kind of approach that he took to analyze from the time of slavery to what happened after slavery with Sheriff Jim Crow to what was going on like now with, you know, coming into the cities, into the proletariat and the implications of all that for revolution, that it was even Black people being in even a more powerful position to contribute to, you know, to revolution, communist revolution and stuff. Objectively, I had never read anything like that. And, you know, and at that time, people was, here's the thing, because people were saying, don't, you know, at least some of the people that I knew, and this was one of the things that was in the movement at that time, don't read anything for somebody like white. They're trying to tell you about, you know, the struggle of Black people or any other oppressed people, because if you listen to them, that shows your chauvinism, because they have no business in here trying to tell you, you're supposed to, like, you know, you, that's your responsibility. Nobody can tell you. But which was bullshit, you know. So they were saying, you know, in terms of this being like social chauvinist, because like I said, I knew B.A. I knew where his heart was. And even the thing like with the Panthers and stuff. And I was, now listen to B.A. talk about, I read what he like, he understands it better. That's what I said this to. He understands it better than I went through. I was in the Panthers. I went, he understands. That's one of the things I was really, when I went to prison, I was so, that's why I was so angry and cocky, because of what like had happened. But he had a rational and scientific understanding about, you know, why they split and got off the road, departed from the road of revolution and stuff. Again, not blaming like them, but they didn't make the leap to become scientific in their understanding of what are we faced with and what kind of leadership do we need in order to be, can this thing be defeated? Can it be overthrown? What kind of leadership do we need? And what kind of methods and approach that we talking about? So that leadership needs to be based upon and stuff.
So there was a lot in that segment. It has a lot of relevance to today. But I thought it was really important when he said towards the end of that segment, when I went to prison, that's why I was so angry, because of what had happened to the Panthers. But B.A. had a rational and a scientific understanding about why they split apart and departed from the road of revolution. Again, not blaming them, but appreciating the very brutal and murderous repression they face, but more so recognizing how they didn't make the leap to becoming scientific about revolution. He said then, nobody in the 60s came up with a real strategy that can lead millions and millions to defeat and overthrow this system. What to replace it with? What kind of leadership do we need? What kind of methods and approach does that leadership need to be based on? So this is very important, because the Panthers did not lack for heroism. They didn't lack for passion. And it's not their fault that they didn't have science. They hit a wall of repression very early in their development. And nobody really had that scientific approach at that time. That's something that had to be developed, and Bob Avakian did that. And then it matters. But what also matters is the story that's in this piece, Bob Avakian for the Liberation of Black People and the Emancipation of Humanity, because it captures that it's not just a theoretical development, but it's actually a person who developed this, a person with a deep understanding of the lives of the masses of people, what they go through, what their aspirations are, what their potential is. So I want to show you a segment from the film B.A. Speaks Revolution, Nothing Less, so that we take our name from. And there's two things about this segment. You just heard Joe talk about Bob Avakian's friend, Billy. And that friendship, those relations, has stayed with Bob Avakian. And in this speech in 2012, he gave a part of the speech we've pulled out as a clip titled, "This System Has No Future for the Youth, But the Revolution Does." And I think you can see in this not only an understanding of what it will take, the scientific approach it takes to emancipate humanity and to liberate Black people, but you really get a sense of, this is somebody who understands the potential of these youth, what they go through, what this system puts them through.
The revolution has a future for the youth, for the masses of youth in this country and throughout the world. This system has no future for them, but the revolution does. A revolution and a future in which these youth can and must have a decisive and increasingly conscious role. People tell us that these youth, especially these youth who are on the bottom being stepped on and beaten down every day, have been reduced to conditions where they could not any longer rise up to play this revolutionary role. But this is not true. People need to think about how hard many of these youth have tried to get out of the conditions they're in and get to some place where they could do something much better. This too gets not only forgotten but consciously covered up. Right now in the California prisons, the people who carried out self-sacrificing hunger strikes have made a call for peace among people of the different races in the prisons. We should understand how tremendously significant and difficult this is. How much is going up against it, both among the masses spontaneously, but also for the workings of the authorities, and how much they'll try to undercut and sabotage this. This needs a lot of support. It needs to be popularized. People need to know about it. They need to support people who have been condemned and cast aside as less than human and the worst of the worst when they reach for something lofty like this. But from the perspective of understanding all that I've been talking about, and for those who do understand this, we need to work to make this part of building a movement for revolution. We need to approach everything in that way and from that framework, even while uniting with other people who have not yet been won to that position and are coming from different perspectives. Or think, let's go back again to the LA Rebellion. Sometimes it's forgotten, and we need to not forget how hard so many of the people caught up in a lot of bad tried to break out of that at that time. From the first night of the rebellion to sometime in its aftermath, there was the graffiti on the wall in LA the first night of the rebellion. Blacks and Mexicans together tonight. Think about what that signified and how significant that was. And then in the aftermath of the rebellion, you had all these attempts at forging unity, overcoming these deep divisions among the people that had grown over years with bitter antagonism. There were unity picnics. There were attempts at unity conferences all around the country. The police would attack the unity picnics. I remember seeing a picture at that time of two young guys, one a Blood and one a Crip, shortly after the rebellion, with their arms around each other. Do we understand the significance of that and how much that means? These are youth who, from a very early age, are taught that they count for nothing and deserve nothing but a boot up their ass and a bullet in their brain, or a long time in jail. And so you have nothing, and you're told to expect nothing. And so you try to get something by carving out a little space on a street in a neighborhood that doesn't belong to you. Doesn't really mean anything, but it's all that you can feel that you can plant yourself in and find some meaning and purpose in. And then there are other people two blocks away, whether you're Mexicans and in your rival gangs, or you're Black in your rival gangs, or Vietnamese, or whatever. People two blocks away just like you. But if they come in the little territory that you've staked out your hood, the rules are they're slipping, you got to shoot them. You shoot them. So then they have to come back and kill you and your family and your friends. And on it goes back and forth for years and years. People kept like in cages. And here they took the step after all these years of this bitter experience of friends and loved ones being killed on both sides back and forth. And the meaning of their putting their arms around each other and trying to forge something different, but the system wouldn't have it and couldn't have it. They attacked the unity picnics time and again. But more than that, the program that these people, these youth and others who, you know, OGs and the gangs and whatever, tried to come up with was a program for reform, for entrepreneurialism that couldn't work under the system. There was no room for it. And so it didn't go anywhere, and then many went back to the old ways, and youth coming up fell back and, you know, were sort of channeled into those ways. But they tried so hard. And so genuinely, heroically, And the problem is that under the system, there's no basis for overcoming these kind of divisions. But in striving for and building a movement for revolution, there is the basis, and this is what we have to be fighting for, to bring forward the full potential of these and other youth and other sections of oppressed people, men and women, to be the backbone and driving force, and win them through a lot of struggle to be that backbone and driving force of this revolution.
So that was Bob Avakian. This system has no future for the youth, but the revolution does. From the film, Bob Avakian speaks, revolution, nothing less. So I think that's going to wrap up our segment on Bob Avakian for the liberation of Black people and the emancipation of all of humanity. As I said, we're going to be returning to that several times over the next several weeks.
That was Bob Avakian for the liberation of Black people and the emancipation of all humanity from the RNL show, which is on the YouTube channel, The RevComs. A new show debuts every Thursday, so don't miss them. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a hit waves through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know.
That was Outer National. Here is The Rose, and now this.
We will stop the steal. Today I will lay out just some of the evidence proving that we won this election, and we won it by a landslide. This was not a close election. And after this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
Yeah! Yeah!
Let's take the Capitol.
Take the Capitol.
Let's take it. Let's take the Capitol.
Fire!
Heard and saw what happened January 6th when Trump led his followers to attack the U.S. Capitol during the counting of electoral votes in an attempted coup. 43 senators have now ruled that it was okay. We will have a lot more to say about this, but right now we're going to hear a segment from a Refuse Fascism video on the Senate impeachment trial and the need to refuse fascism with Sam Goldman of Refuse Fascism and Jared Yates Sexton, professor and political analyst.
An unpunished coup becomes a training exercise and a green light for the return to power. In 1923, Hitler was lightly punished for an attempted coup and was in power 10 years later. We should learn from that historical experience of fascism. January 6th was an attempt to retain a fascist leader in power. And when we talk about an acquittal leaving the door open to fascism, we aren't worried that fascism might just wander back in. It's bloodthirsty. They are already climbing through the windows and scaling the walls. Conviction is the least we can do. This week, the world will be watching to see if the rule of law will remain in the most powerful country in the world. That is what is at stake in whether Trump is convicted and held to account. And while right now it does not seem the conviction is likely, this too can change. The 2020 election was a showdown over the form of rule in this country. A second Trump term would have allowed a leap and rapid consolidation of fascism in the most powerful country in the world, real possibilities of an escalation of ethnic cleansing at the border, unleashed white supremacist terror, anti-science lunacy, killing hundreds of thousands more from COVID. For months before the election, and for years when it comes down to it, Trump claims that any election he lost would be illegitimate, spread lies about immigrants voting illegally, and in plain sight, attempted to sabotage the election, from blackmailing the president of Ukraine to voter intimidation to disrupting the US Postal Service. After Trump lost the election, he refused to concede, even as lawsuit after lawsuit challenging the results were thrown out. His backers attempted to cancel millions of ballots from the largely Black urban voters of swing states. His rabid followers vowed to keep coming back to DC to fight for Trump, culminating in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. That they did not succeed in overturning the election does not change what it was, a violent coup attempt by fascists in and out of government, fighting to stay in power so that they could rule over everyone else they hate with white supremacist, misogynistic, xenophobic terror. Many thought that Trump and Trumpism was over in the days following the coup attempt. It was extremely important and right that Nancy Pelosi fought for impeachment, underscoring, as she said, the danger is here in Congress. And conviction and barring from future office must be won. But since January 6th, there has been every effort to rewrite, forget, move on, change the subject. Fascism does not stop out of shame. It does not stop unless it is stopped. Instead, we have seen the battle over Trump's conviction become a medium for Trumpism to reshape and reseize the initiative, consolidating the GOP into a fully fascist party. Fascist, yes, openly bloody dictatorship, without even the pretense of rights for the people. This week, there is a monumental necessity and a real basis for an uncompromising fight for conviction. The full truth of what happened on January 6th and everything leading up to it must be exposed. The GOP's absolute disregard for the truth or objective reality or free and fair elections must be frontally taken on. Some are already arguing that because it looks extremely unlikely now that they will get 17 Republicans on board to win a conviction, that even waging an all-out fight in the trial over these questions is not worth it, or may even do harm. This is wrong. For one thing, you don't know in advance what can happen when a full-throated fight is waged. A stark case against Trump with evidence and testimony and a real political fight can change public opinion throughout the country. And a mass movement demanding conviction can be won through this. And if that is won, then that could, even if it seems unlikely at this point, tip things towards conviction. And even if it is not won, the more clearly this is fought, the more the stakes are clarified, the stronger position we will be in for the ongoing fight we will then have to take up to defeat and repudiate this fascism. The road to capitulation in advance leads where? Potentially past concentration camps, past death camps, to a real existential peril to humanity. Before January 6th, we were confronted by a fascist movement in power here and rising around the world. And it's not going away quietly because the conditions bringing it into being have not gone away. As revolutionary leader Babavakian has analyzed, global warming is not only threatening humanity, but disrupting the rule of American empire. Heightened globalization is ripping up and spitting out communities, regions, even whole countries across the global South, while tearing up the social fabric right here in the belly of the beast, all pushing the gaping wounds of capitalism, imperialism to extremes. Fascism is one possible solution to many of these contradictions in the interests of the American empire. While the fascist has been voted out, the fascism hasn't been removed. And now, more than possibly ever before, this country is full of fascists, millions of them. If the fascist base were the majority, we would still need to take action to stop them. But the fact is that the fascist social base is a minority, both in terms of the population, and now that's reflected in the Senate, House, and executive branch. But this only matters if this power is acted upon. We don't know how this will turn out, but we need to take a lesson from Babavakian. The politics of the possible is the politics of the monstrosity. To adhere to or acquiesce in the politics of the possible is to support and actually to facilitate monstrosity. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.
To begin, I just want to say that this is, of course, a political discussion, but simply to say the word politics right now is to somehow or another, in modern times, to pretend like you're playing some sort of a game. And one of the things I've been very disturbed by over the last couple of weeks, and particularly the last couple of days, has been this idea of whether or not this impeachment trial is smart politics, or, you know, we keep reading these articles now from people among the Democratic Party saying they're not so sure that they should have witnesses, they should spend a lot of time on this, considering there's a foregone conclusion of what's going to happen. But when I say politics, I'm not talking about this game of politics. I'm not talking about what is smart, what's practical, what's going to make an agenda happen. What I'm talking about is how a group of disparate people come together and decide how to live in a shared society. And that's what's in danger right now. This is the actual problem that we're having, is that we have reached a point where shared society is in the middle of a political, social, and existential crisis. And I want to state very clearly, because there has been, for the past month and 2 days, there has been a concerted effort by politicians, media, pundits, to frame this whole thing as a weird aberration that took place on, you know, January 6th. And it just so happened that there was a riot that spilled into the U.S. Capitol. And it's really terrible what happened, but we've moved past it and we've turned the page and Donald Trump is behind us and now we can unify and move on. That's unfortunately a fairy tale. We have a real problem in this country. And I want to go ahead and say, first and foremost, what happened on January 6th. And this is the way history will look at it if we have history. The president of the United States of America, after fomenting one conspiracy theory after another for years, and then engaging in a fascistic, white supremacist paranoid conspiracy theory, sicked his radicalized followers on his own vice president and the legislative branch of the United States of America. He declared war on the government of the United States and tried to carry out a violent coup. We were incredibly lucky that it didn't move further. That's not a pretty picture. That's one of the reasons we're trying to move on from it. We're trying to pretend because there's a new president that everything will be totally fine. But it's not. There is a fascistic movement in this country. And I have to tell you, if this happens and he is acquitted and there isn't an actual good faith, full-throated prosecution of him that shows the country, by the way, that not only was it a lie that Donald Trump told, but that it was a weaponized lie that the wealthy and the powerful helped him tell. If that conspiracy theory, which by the way, is just an ancestor of other conspiracy theories that have led to fascistic takeovers, Holocaust, mass killings, and mass oppressions, if we don't actually deal with that, we're going to go back to sleep. We're going to forget that January 6th happened and how it happened and who made it happen. And I have to tell you, we're not going to be lucky enough to have somebody come after Donald Trump who is as incompetent and cowardly as he is. There are groups of people in this country with a lot of money and a lot of power in the Republican Party, which, by the way, has no platform. It has no plan to help Americans besides to mislead Americans they've exploited and take their anger and push it elsewhere and weaponize them and radicalize them. They will find somebody who can approximate all of the characteristics that made Donald Trump Donald Trump, but that person will have an actual ideology and that person will actually be disciplined. And I'm really glad that when Sam read that statement that this came up. We are reaching a real giant, bigger moment of crisis in the United States of America. Our economy is falling apart. People are becoming more alienated and more radicalized by the day. And global climate change is a catastrophe that is going to not only destroy our economy, it's going to throw our politics into further tumult. And it's also going to lead, and I'm sorry, but what we saw at the border is only going to be worse with millions upon millions of climate refugees. If we don't nip this thing in the bud, if we don't call it what it is, if we don't fight against this like our very lives depend on it, because they do, we are going to be shit out of luck when the next iteration reaches, because this situation has been created, it has been fomented, it has been absolutely tended to, and we have to deal with this like the actual crisis that it is.
That was Sam Goldman and Jared Yates Sexton talking about the Senate impeachment trial and the need to refuse fascism. All right, that was John Fogerty with Can't Take It No More. A couple of weeks ago, we announced the Zoom Into the Revolution seminars to get into the New Year statement by Bob Avakian. A new year, the urgent need for a radically new world for the emancipation of all humanity, and to discuss with other like-minded folks from other perspectives. The email address to get signed up is getorganizedforrevolutiontour@gmail.com. And right now, I want to play a piece by Prose, a member of the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution Tour, on the nature and importance of these seminars and why anyone can participate.
Speaking about why people should, you know, be excited and register to join with these different seminars and group discussions and how important that could be, there are people that I think generally feel kind of locked out or intimidated by some of the more like heavy theoretical stuff. People like my sister, she's never really seen herself as having enough knowledge or expertise or confidence to even understand like what shapes reality, anything in the realm of politics, you know, she feels scared off from and feels like she shouldn't have an opinion about, which just isn't the case at all. You know, there are people like her and so many others I know, speaking about like the different collectivity I was a part in like getting into this statement. We all come from different walks of life. We share similar experiences. We have very different experiences. And the unevenness among us and how we understand the world and how we approach things. And then the coming together to actually like surface what's in the statement and get deeply into how we understand it, not just on the surface, but having to work through our thinking. You know, I think it's just really beneficial. I've gotten a lot out of it. I've spoken to people about some of the substance in the statement, and, you know, we're having a discussion about like how they see what happened on the 6th. I'm asking them how they understand fascism. And, you know, as they're engaging the statement, we're talking about the appreciation we have for like the, you know, the analysis that BA has given about like the economic base and how that's developed and how that changes the social relations. You know, if I happen to be like pretty caffeinated and I'm passionate about what I'm saying, they're like, wow, you know, you sound like you have a lot of conviction and behind what you're saying. I wish I had that much conviction. Or they say like, oh, I didn't think about things that way before. And I'm learning from them as well. But, the thing is, I say like, you know, we should get together and we should have more of these discussions. I volunteer with the social media team, and we put on Zoom discussions over different articles that BA has written in the past. Yeah, so when people are saying like, oh, I wish I had that conviction, or oh, that's like, I never had that understanding, and they're, you know, they seem to be, you know, expressing that they're getting a lot out of our discussion, I say like, it's not as if I just, you know, I can just sit in a room alone and like recite what I know in a mirror. It's through a process of collective wrangling with reality. It's through a process of being excited to try and take on these difficult subjects about like what's happening and why is it actually happening. And it's through like a spirit of curiosity and inquiry and for a reason, for the emancipation of humanity, where you can be excited if you're struggled with and you're wrong. And sometimes you can be struggled with and you can be really stubborn about it. But you know, this process about coming to know and understand the world scientifically, it's something that can't just happen in like some vacuum sealed experience. We have to be working with reality as it changes. And there's no greater strength that we have. I mean, I think, you know, the strength that we have definitely is like the leadership of BA and the whole framework of a scientific method and approach to reality. Like that sets the foundation. And then our collectivity on top of that, and bringing in our different strengths and different weaknesses and different perspectives, and all with a common goal in mind of like, how are we going to work together to get to communism, to get beyond the four alls by Marx, to get beyond these, you know, class divisions and oppressive relations. And, you know, how are we going to emancipate humanity together and with that spirit actually go to work together? So I think that's a big reason why people should feel compelled and not intimidated. They should feel really excited that these seminars are going to happen. And I encourage people to join them and participate and contribute their insights and what they don't know and their questions, because we can work through that together and all get a lot out of it.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with the Isley Brothers, Fight the Power. Talk to you again next week. Through the wasteland.